It's cold season, and with that comes all kinds of folk remedies and old wives' tales about what causes colds and how to treat them. So we thought that we would look into them and some of the other folk medical advice, like does caffeine stunt your growth, or that chocolate causes acne, or that sitting too close to the television set will ruin your eyesight. Here to sort out fact from fiction are Anahad O'Connor, columnist for the New York Times Well blog and author of the books Always Follow the Elephants and Never Shower in a Thunderstorm, which are both published by Times Books, and Dr. Rachel Vreeman, assistant professor of pediatrics at Indiana University and co-author of Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Health. Also, Don't Cross Your Eyes, They'll Stay That Way, and 75 Other Health Myths Debunked. Those are both published by St. Martin's Griffin. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And by the way, we are taking listener calls. If you have questions about medical myths, we're calling them myths. Maybe they're not all myths. Give us a call at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. So, Rachel, let's begin with you. Is there any truth to the saying, starve a fever, feed a cold?
You know, there really isn't, and it's even manifest by the fact that some people say, you know, starve a cold, feed a fever. It goes both ways. Essentially, your body is really good at knowing what you should do when you're sick. You need fluids, and you should have some food, but it's okay if your appetite is down for a little while. So it's really more a matter of paying attention to our bodies, whether we have a cold or fever or the flu or whatever else is going on.
And should that fluid be chicken soup?
Well, interestingly enough, so many cold remedies have been studied over and over again, things that we really put a lot of trust in, vitamin C, echinacea, and the evidence for them is not great. Chicken soup, however, in the few studies that have been done, there's some evidence that it might help boost some of the cells of your immune system a little bit.
And I've heard people say you shouldn't drink milk or eat any dairy products when you have a cold. Is that good advice?
Yeah, that's something else that hasn't really been confirmed in studies. And as Dr. Vreeman was saying, it's really your body is good at knowing what to do. And the research that has looked at cold remedies has mostly found that hot liquids are very effective, which is partly the reason why chicken soup may also have an effect. It helps clear congestion. And then also there's one study that found that it had cysteine in it, which is, I guess, chemically related to a compound called acetylcysteine, which is a drug that helps clear up congestion. So it's really the hot fluids, and chicken soup is one of them.
But what about dairy products? What about, should we drink milk?
Yeah, there was research looking at that that found that there was nothing really supporting this claim that it causes more phlegm or mucus.
They also...
And then it may just be more of an illusion based on the fact that it causes, it coats your throat a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Garlic has also been proposed for fighting a cold, and whiskey, that's a nice way to fight a cold. They don't work either, I assume.
Well, you know, garlic is actually kind of an interesting one. In a number of studies that have been done looking at garlic and whether it cures colds, there was really only one that seems like it gave pretty good answers about garlic. It actually had pretty high-quality research. And in that one, the group of people who were taking garlic did have fewer days of illness overall, but the number of days that it took for them to get better once they were sick was the same. So there was some sense that maybe garlic was helping a little bit, but they noted there are lots of not-so-great side effects from garlic, in particular having a bad odor. So you might want to weigh the bad smell versus maybe fewer colds.
Now, I was... go ahead, Anna.
People who eat a lot of garlic may just benefit from less exposure to the cold.
They're keeping people away from them.
Exactly.
Oh, but more and more of us are eating garlic these days. I just recently came back from a vacation and had a wonderful time. And the next morning, I woke up with a sore throat. And everybody said, well, that's because you were in an airplane. Does flying in an airplane make you more likely to catch a cold or some other virus that will make you sick?
It really doesn't seem to. Now, a lot of people are convinced that airplanes are are, you know, incubators for coughs and colds. I actually travel quite a bit because I work in Kenya half the time, and my family swears that every time I go onto the plane, I'm going to get sick. But airplanes are not as bad as people think. In fact, they're really no worse in terms of the number of things you're exposed to than other forms of public transportation or other places where you're with lots of people. And the air circulation systems, the ventilation systems, actually work pretty well to keep the cabin clean. Now, that doesn't mean that you're not at risk if you're sitting, you know, right next to someone who's sick. There is certainly some risk there, but it's not as though, you know, viruses are spreading throughout the entire plane to the extent that we often are afraid of.
My guests are Dr. Rachel Vreeman, assistant professor of pediatrics at Indiana University, and Anna Had O'Connor, columnist for the New York Times. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're taking your calls at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Rachel, what about schools and daycare? Do kids get sick more often there?
Well, as a pediatrician, we hear parents worrying about this one all the time, and there's some truth to it. So children who go to daycare do have more infections, more colds, and other viruses early on in life when they first are starting to go to daycare. But if you look at the number of infections that they have overall, they don't have any more in total than children who don't go to daycare. So the children who stay home and avoid daycare, they get all of their coughs and colds and other illnesses when they start school. So they just get them a little bit later. It's not a big difference in the number of those infections overall.
But Anna, it does seem like colds are more common in colder months. Is that true? Is it because germs are more effective then, or is it because we tend to stay inside more and that means that we are in incubator situations?
There's actually been a lot of research on this going back many years, and much of it has been done at the Common Cold Center out in Cardiff in England. And they have actually found that it really is or has something to do with the people being inside and in closer confines, and that there doesn't seem to be anything in particular about cold weather that raises the risk of getting a cold.
So going out into cold weather without a warm coat on or with wet hair won't make you catch a cold?
It's not that you won't catch a cold. It's really there just isn't any proof that being cold in and of itself is enough to substantially raise your risk of catching the virus, because you have to be exposed to the virus. I mean, that's basically what causes it.
And I think it's so interesting how they do those studies, because they actually put the cold viruses into volunteers' noses and then put them in these different conditions, you know, with wet hair or a warm coat or so on, and they really look at who is more likely to get infected, and they don't see the differences there.
Does sweating out a fever help bring it down? And some other people suggest that you get into an ice bath. Does that work with a fever?
Well, interestingly enough, an ice bath certainly can bring your body temperature down rapidly, but it causes some difficulty in terms of how your brain regulates your body temperature, that it can, in fact, alter your set point, making your body think that it needs to work even harder to try to warm up your body temperature. In a sense, it's revving up the fever center in that sort of way. So you really have to be careful. If you want to bring someone's body temperature down, we typically would recommend, even in cases where we want to do that more quickly, to use lukewarm water, not something ice cold, because that really alters the body's set point in a way that's not particularly helpful.
Well, fevers tend to get more intense in the morning and the evening. They seem to go down during the middle of the day. Do we have any idea why? And does a fever going down mean that you're getting better? Go ahead, Anna. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that this relates to the saying, you know, starve a fever. And part of that belief is that by starving yourself, you're lowering your body's temperature. And by feeding a cold, when you eat, your body temperature rises, and that helps fight the cold. But that's, as we sort of touched on, there's no truth to that as well. But that relates to the whole body temperature issue, which hasn't been shown in studies to really have an impact.
What about the fevers going up and down? Do we have any idea why they seem to be higher in the morning and the evening and lower during the middle of the day?
I haven't seen any research on that in particular.
Yeah, it's certainly a documented phenomenon. It is how our body seems to kind of rotate through temperatures in the course of even a normal day when you're not sick and not having fevers. Your body temperature does have fluctuations where it's typically a bit higher earlier in the day and then higher again later in the day. And that seems to be more emphasized when you're sick. But exactly why that happens or what the benefit of that is not known.
And there are a lot of old wives' tales concerning pregnancy. And one is that women have worse morning sickness with girls than with boys, or maybe it's the other way around, I'm not sure. Is there any truth to that?
There was one very large study of about 12,000 pregnant women, which did find that women who had a lot of morning sickness in the first trimester had a greater percentage of girls. And they found that this was particularly the case with women who had very, very severe morning sickness to the point where they had to be hospitalized.
And we have any idea why that would be?
They didn't know why. They couldn't really find an explanation. But it was a pretty startling connection. And like I said, it was only in the first trimester and was only with very severe morning sickness that in many cases led to hospitalization. These women had like an 80% greater chance of having girls. They've shown in other studies looking at other old wives' tales on pregnancy and the baby's gender that hormones seem to play a role. For example, there is the old wives' tale about women with heartburn being more likely to have babies with a lot of hair. And that's one that they found was true. And they showed that there was a connection between a hormone that relaxes the sphincter, the esophageal sphincter, and that also causes fetal hair growth. So there seems to be a connection with hormones in some of these cases where these old wives' tales come true among pregnant women.
Rachel, is it unsafe for a pregnant woman to dye her hair, as I've been told?
It is not. There's a lot of worry about this, and there have not been the types of, randomized controlled trials that we often use to answer these questions, in part because it just hasn't been feasible to do that. But the overwhelming evidence that the experts cite is the fact that dyeing hair and or coloring hair is so common among women, and we really don't see increases in birth defects, miscarriages, and so on that seem to be related to that. So while there is fear about this, there doesn't seem to be much evidence to back it up.
And people also will tell you that spicy food can induce labor.
That's something that hasn't been shown in studies. The other thing with the hair dye issue is that a lot of the concerns from the hair dye were based on hair dyes that were made in the 70s. And which had a lot more carcinogens. And nowadays, hair dyes have been stripped of most of these carcinogens that raised these fears. So, I mean, there's really not an issue today, and health authorities say that women shouldn't worry about it.
We're told that we should drink at least 8 cups of water a day. Is there any medical evidence that supports that?
Not. This is, of course, one that people get very upset about when we talk about it at times. But essentially, the body requires fluid in the equivalent amount to close to 8 glasses of water a day. But it's really 8 glasses worth of fluid that your body needs. And the things that you eat, fruits and vegetables and so on, count for this amount. Other things that you drink count. So there's nice studies to show that coffee, tea, soda, and so on all are, in fact, helping to hydrate your body and counting towards the amount of fluid that you need. So if you want to drink 8 glasses of water, you can, but we actually do a good job of keeping ourselves hydrated with what we're typically taking in terms of what we eat and what we drink in an average day.
Does a glass of warm milk help you fall asleep?
There have been a lot of studies looking at things that help people fall asleep, and mostly what they found is that there is no surefire food sleep remedy, but that there is sort of a psychological effect, so that if people strongly believe that warm milk helps them fall asleep or their favorite fuzzy blanket helps them fall asleep, then it has sort of a psychologically comforting effect, and there might be that sort of placebo effect.
My guests are Anahad O'Connor, columnist for the New York Times, well blog, and author of the books Always Follow the Elephants and Never Shower in a Thunderstorm, which are both published by Times Books, and Dr. Rachel Vreeman, assistant professor of pediatrics at Indiana University and co-author of Don't Swallow Your Gum, Myths, Half-Truths, and Outright Lies About Your Body and Health, and Don't Cross Your Eyes, They'll Stay That Way, and 75 Other Health Myths Debunked, both published by St. Martin's Griffin. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, more questions and your questions. Give us a call at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And we are back with our guests, Anahad O'Connor and Dr. Rachel Vreeman. We're talking about medical old wives' tales. Some of them turn out to actually be good advice. Most of them turn out not to be. We are taking your calls here on this Please Explain segment at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's get right to one of those calls. Mary Nell from Manhattan, you're on the air.
Okay, great. Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was at my girlfriend's house babysitting, and it started storming outside and lightning. The windows were open. I was trying to get air, and she came home, and she started closing all the windows. She was freaked out that the lightning was going to come through the windows. And I was like, I don't think it works that way, but I wonder.
What about lightning? Does it come through windows?
No, but in some very rare cases, it can come through plumbing and metal fixtures in the house. And my first book, Never Shower in a Thunderstorm, the title comes from this issue. Because basically every year in the United States, there are about a dozen or so cases of people being struck by lightning indoors. But this only happens in very, very rural areas where the buildings don't have proper grounding. And the electricity can run through plumbing and pipes. And if you're touching a faucet when this happens, then you can be electrocuted. And this happens with washing machines and other metal appliances. But in big towns and cities like New York, the buildings are properly grounded, so you don't get lightning hitting people indoors. And it's also more of an issue in third world countries, but not in places like New York City and big cities.
Before we get to any more calls, I want to talk about eyesight for a moment. I've been told that reading in bad light hurts your eyes. Does it?
It really doesn't. Even though many of us hear this one or heard this from our parents or grandparents and so on, there is not good evidence to suggest that reading in dim light will do anything to permanently ruin your eyes. Now, it certainly can cause eye strain, which can make your vision blurry temporarily, can give you a headache, make your eyes feel dry and uncomfortable. But the evidence seems to suggest that when you return to well-lit conditions, your eyesight returns to normal. And, of course, there's the fact that even though, for reasons we don't fully understand, more and more people are needing glasses and having vision that needs to be corrected, we've never had better light in the history of the world. You know, people used to primarily read by lanterns and candlelight, and our light is much better now. And yet we still see this increased need for glasses.
Well, one of the reasons I've been told is that we're reading more, and that leads to nearsightedness. In the past, if you were working the fields, you'd probably be farsighted. Does that make any sense to you?
It's certainly an explanation that makes sense to us, but the evidence is not as clear on it as we might think. So there's absolutely this sense that with increased visual experiences, they're called, so you know, having to use your eyes in more intense ways, that might lead to more problems with your vision. But it's typically only been looked at in really extreme settings where people are, for example, doing very fine work, very close up and close to their eyes. There's the evidence that looks at, you know, and there seems to be some connection in terms of, like, needing glasses and having more academic experiences. But exactly how that works or what the cause is has not really been determined well.
And then my parents told me that if I sat too close to the television set, it would hurt my eyes, but also told me that I had to eat carrots because I had bad eyes. Do either of those things turn out to be true? Anahad?
With the television, or sitting close to television, it's the same issue as Dr. Freeman was just saying. It can cause eye strain, but there's no evidence that it can actually permanently damage your eyes. And the carrots one is one that goes back decades to World War II. That was actually a myth started by the British Royal Air Force, whose fighter pilots had a very high success rate at shooting down German fighter planes. And it was because they were using radar, which they wanted to keep a secret. So they came up with this great tale of how their best fighter pilots were eating lots of carrots, which helped with their night vision. And so that myth kind of stuck. But there's really no evidence from studies that eating carrots improves your eyesight.
John from Paramus, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my mother would never let me go swimming after I ate, at least about 3 hours. How true is that? I could never understand that. Is that true or not? Do you get something to be eating and swimming?
It's not true. I heard my parents told me this exact same thing. We had a pool, and there was this rule, like you couldn't touch a toe into the water. If
so
you
would
just
drown. Like
yes,
you'd get,
exactly.
Yeah.
You'd cramp immediately.
You'd
and
drown,
so
yeah.
Interestingly, there's not evidence of this actually happening. There have not been cases of drowning or near drowning that have been tied to people eating too quickly. Now, there is the caveat with that, that when our bodies are digesting, you know, there's this possibility that it could lead to cramping or increased fatigue and so on. But the key here is common sense. Like, this would happen whether you were doing any sort of, you know, significant exertion right after eating. So if you're swimming in a place where if you were to begin to have problems, that's just not a good idea at any time. If you, you know, if you're in a place where you're, there's no way you're going to be able to get to safety or people can't see you and so on. But there's not evidence that actually ties the eating with a particular time. I think it's mostly that the parents need a rest from watching children in the pool.
John, thank you for your call.
A couple things to add to that. Keep in mind that Michael Phelps is known to eat about 6,000 or 7,000 calories within an hour of jumping in the pool, and that earned him a record number of gold medals. The other thing, on a slightly more serious note, is that the only food substance that has been related to problems in the swimming pool is alcohol. And in studies by the Red Cross, that's the only thing that you know, that's been shown to increase the risk of drowning. But that's something that everyone should be aware of.
So SUI is another offense. Since we're talking about food, Thanksgiving is coming up, and we hear about eating turkey, that it makes you feel tired because it contains tryptophan. Is that true?
Well, turkey does contain tryptophan, and everyone knows that, you know, tryptophan is this amino acid that seems to be linked to sleep, that it can actually, it's actually sold as a dietary supplement to aid in sleep, and it certainly can be effective that way. But the key to remember is that turkey does not contain an exceptional amount of tryptophan. It doesn't contain any more per gram than chicken or beef, and pork actually contains more tryptophan per gram than turkey does, as do things like Swiss cheese. But no one is ever blaming their ham and Swiss sandwich for, you know, sending them instantly off to sleep. We do know, though, that eating a large amount, a really large meal, and, of course, drinking alcohol, these things are quite clearly linked to being sleepier. And so I think there are other things to blame in the Thanksgiving dinner. The turkey needs to be exonerated.
People have been writing in their questions. Jenna in Hamilton Heights writes, does megadosing on vitamin C really help fight a cold? Does anything actually help shorten the lifespan of a cold?
There's been a lot of studies on this. They've looked at everything from zinc to, you know, vitamin C to echinacea, and there really hasn't been any solid evidence supporting any of these things, including vitamin C. Zinc, you know, they have found that, and there's been a lot of studies on zinc and colds, it hasn't really been shown to be effective. Echinacea hasn't really been shown to be effective unless you're taking it in advance. People who take echinacea, they've been shown to have a lower likelihood of acquiring as many colds, but taking it once the cold starts, it doesn't make
so we
any
have
difference.
To take it every day and hope that we never get a cold?
Well, that's the other thing, is that there are side effects. So, you know, it's kind of a balance. You know, does it really make much of a difference? It may shorten or reduce the number of colds that you get per year by a small amount, but is it worth the side effects?
A listener in Astoria really asks, what about drafts? Can they cause colds and muscle aches?
It goes along, you know, with the same thing about going out into cold weather and so on. There's just not evidence that being exposed to a draft or being exposed to cold in that way, that is what's going to make you sick. It's, first of all, the viruses or, you know, the particular germs that are actually causing your illness and the conditions that you're in, other than being really close to someone who is clearly passing on those same germs. But otherwise, the weather conditions don't seem to make much of a difference.
But muscle aches and stiff necks?
I have not really seen much in the way of research on muscle aches or stiff necks related to cold temperatures. Anna, do you have any for those?
No, I haven't seen anything supporting that.
Diana in Manhattan asks, is it true that nightshade vegetables increase inflammation?
There is some evidence showing that there is a higher rate of allergies to nightshade vegetables, but not necessarily inflammation.
A number of people have asked about stunting growth, caffeine, and then also doing exercises, certain kinds of exercise with weights when you're young. Does that stunt growth
caffeine
at all?
Caffeine does not stunt your growth, which I think is quite an interesting one, especially because I come from a family of a lot of coffee drinkers, and so this was always the concern. But they're really in nice prospective studies that follow people who are drinking coffee or drinking caffeine. This doesn't seem to be the case. The caffeine is not preventing your body from absorbing the calcium in the ways that people often worry about. It does slightly limit how well your gut absorbs calcium, but your body actually compensates for that really well by decreasing how much calcium it gets rid of in the overall period. So overall, there are not big differences in how you absorb calcium related to caffeine, and it doesn't seem to have any effect on your bone growth or your bone density, your bone health measured in other ways at all.
Does exercising on an empty stomach burn more fat?
The thing about this one is that they've shown in studies that it may have a slight effect, but the downside is that when you exercise without food in your stomach, you're exercising with less energy, and so you're going to exercise for a shorter period of time. So in the end, there's really no benefit, because instead of exercising for 45 minutes or an hour, you're only able to exercise for half that amount of time, and not as intensely.
Rachel, does shaving hair make it grow back thicker, as I've been told many times?
It does not. This one is I think, caused by an optical illusion. When we shave hair, it does nothing to affect the rate of growth, largely because it's just cutting off the dead portion of the hair from up above the surface. In fact, there have been nice controlled trials where they look at whether the hair is growing back at a different rate, whether it's growing back faster, darker, or thicker. The key, though, is when you cut off that hair, the edge that's left is very blunt, and so it often seems to us more coarse and thick, and it has not yet had a chance to be bleached in the normal process of lightening that happens when hair is exposed to the sun and to other chemicals and so on. So it looks darker to us, but really it's not coming in any differently than the hair would elsewhere otherwise.
Joe from Queens, you're on the air.
How about fish food as brain food? Any truth to that?
Well, there's certainly a lot of evidence linking omega-3s to obvious neurological benefits. So there's been a lot of research looking at that. They've also shown that women who have higher amounts of omega-3s, that their babies do tend to see a benefit, at least in a few studies. But, of course, then there are the, you know, FDA recommendations for women, suggesting that they limit their intake of fish because of all of the other toxic substances.
Now, Anahead, I've heard that yawning cools the brain. Where did that idea come from?
You know, yawning is something that's been looked at by a surprising number of scientists, and we do know that yawning is contagious. And there were a few really good studies showing that yawning actually varies by season, that it tends to increase in the winter and decrease in the summer. And the reason they think this is because the brain overheats, and so it wants to take in cooler air to offset the heating. And in the summertime, yawning just takes in warm air, so it doesn't really have the cooling effect. And in the wintertime, you're taking in air that's cooler than body temperature, so it has this cooling effect. And the reason that we see it in people who are sleepy or drowsy, it's believed, is because being sleep deprived tends to raise the brain's temperature.
So but why do we yawn? Why do we yawn? And why does it seem that when one person yawns, everyone has to yawn? Are they contagious?
Well, yawning definitely is contagious. They've done studies showing that if you have someone watch videos of people yawning, that they start yawning. But when you apply cool ice packs to their heads, the yawning goes away. We're not really sure why it's contagious. They think that it may have some evolutionary purposes. For example, you know, thousands of years ago when we traveled in groups and some people had to watch and be on the lookout for danger, yawning kind of sent a signal to others to...
Let's get out of here.
Yeah, exactly.
Rachel, what about the idea that chocolate causes acne and fried foods do?
You know, the idea with this one is that greasy things and chocolate in particular also kind of gets added into that category, that has a significant effect on your degrees of acne. And the evidence really is just not there. I'm happy to say that chocolate can be exonerated in this one. Although there are interesting studies, I mean, it shows that you know, a lot of people believe that their acne is linked to what they eat. But when you look at sort of how that varies from place to place, it really doesn't seem to be the particular foods that are to blame.
Well, we did have a Caleb from Jersey City suggesting that there's a placebo effect in many of these cases, even if there isn't an actual medical reason. We have to leave it there, unfortunately. It's been a fascinating Please Explain with Dr. Rachel Vreeman and Anahad O'Connor. Thank you both so much for talking with us today.